Welcome back. This is part two of On Prophecy, C.G. Jung and Peter Kingsley. So be sure you have listened to part one for this to make the most sense. I want to describe the scene right now. We had a huge rain last night in Asheville. It was glorious. It was just a downpour. I know parts of the country are just parched right now. I know Kentucky is experiencing severe flooding. So my heart goes out to all those experiencing weather that is challenging or even tragic. But in this particular moment, the rains were welcome and abundant, and it sort of made this morning quieter. This is the last morning of August. Of July. I'm thinking about August. And I will post this today because this is our second podcast for July. But because of the rain last night, it's a quieter morning. It's a little more overcast and gray this morning. But as I sit before my mic right now, there's this gentle bit of sun coming in the window through all the green that's right before my window. And so it's this lovely diffused space. So I think that's lending its joy and beauty and wisdom to what we'll talk about today. I certainly feel blessed to be bathed in it right now. I want to begin by acknowledging the new moon that started just a few days ago. So we are now in the cycle of the sturgeon moon, which refers to fish and the abundance of fall that is approaching, although we still have all of August and, 3 weeks of September before we officially tip into fall, into the autumnal season, which is my favorite season. I just have to put a shout out there to fall. It's cyclically a time of year where in the Northern Hemisphere, the harvests begin to come in. So early August is a celebration of that. And this sturgeon moon, certainly in Native American lore and tradition, was when the fish were certainly caught and harvested. And sturgeon can supply a magnificent feast. It's my understanding that they can become quite large, but they are these silvery darting fish. And then they grow into quite a large size, is my understanding. So I wrote some pieces about that and about welcoming the idea of autumn, even though we're not quite there yet. But definitely moving into the season of plenty, into the season of harvest and early harvests. So this is what I wrote about the new moon. Did you know that the sky broke into refreshing showers tonight, cooling, cleansing, making things new? Did you know that the people you know best can still surprise you? Did you know that you can still surprise yourself? Did you know that walking under layers of gray-gray sky is calming, allowing the intrepid star to shine all the more brightly? Did you know that breathing the deep breath, slipping beneath the untamed mind, is good, solid work to build a life around? Did you know we are traveling with the sturgeon moon now, the abundance of fish in their silvery wonder? And the waxing moon. I cherish autumn, and while we are still 1 month away from its official arrival, I revel in the cooler mornings and quieter evenings. In the expansive sky, a steady blue, ready to contrast with the approaching orange and yellow hues. In the earthy pungency of produce, still warm from the soil. We are tipping toward a sensory feast, and it reminds me how much I have right now. I am awash in blessing and promise. The sturgeon moon, historically marking the abundance of life-sustaining fish, is fine occasion to dwell in the feeling of plenty. as the crickets sing tonight, as the breeze stirs a thousand leaves overhead, as I rock on my porch and dream, I commune with all that is. So I'm wishing you, wherever you are today, the beautiful, important feeling of the beginning of harvests in your life. Whatever you have been working on externally or internally, and both, it's a beautiful moment, and I feel we're very close to the gods when we see those harvests start to appear internally and externally. And speaking for myself, it seems like I've been on a long journey of inner harvests for a while, years, I would say, where I've really been focusing on inner harvests. And I've had to set the appearance of outer harvests aside a bit and not get distracted by that, because I have been consciously moving into a space where I know that the inner creates the outer. And there's a time where we doubt that and where the ego pushes back, and that's just the nature of it. And that ego self, self with a capital S, like we have talked about in the past in the CG Jungian sense of self, meaning the ultimate wholeness, the push-pull between the ego and the self is really important, because the ego must bow ultimately to the self, to the divine that is revealing itself through us. But the ego also has to become strong enough to contain that. You know, otherwise it would be like 1,000 watts of electricity going through something that could hold 1 watt. And so the ego has to bow and then push back and then bow and then push back. And it sort of dawned on me yesterday, because I've always said that and I've always felt that to be true, but a bit more clarity dawned around that for me yesterday. So I'm like, well, that it's actually strengthening the ego in a new sense, not in the old way where we may have had a strong ego. It's sort of like the ego gets stripped bare as we let go of these identities and roles and conditioned thought patterns that we indulge in unconsciously for much of our lives. And then we start to let that strip itself away. And then I would argue that a different form of ego that has to somehow still be a strong container for the divine that is emerging through it is created. And so I like thinking of sort of that big ego of the past, hopefully for many of us, where we're working a lot on letting those very human layers go, those human blocks to our own joy and love and power, letting those go, doing that mental discipline, that mental focus of that work. But yet the ego will push back, and there's this beautiful idea of in Jungian thought of that ego self pushback, where it's almost like the presence of a god is required to push back against a god, which is required to birth a god. I know that may sound really cryptic, but yet I think in your soul space, it does not. So it's like a god must call out a god to birth a god. And we're talking again about the deep mystery here. We're talking about paradox. We're talking about places that don't have words to really shape this frontier that we are traveling in. It is the unknown, and it is largely without words. But there's an image for you, a god calling out a god to birth a god. You know, this really magical, in the good sense, magical thinking there. Profound, creative matrix thinking there. So just as a recap of the roads we traveled in the last podcast, I want to touch on again the fact that prophecy is a loaded term. It is for me too. You know, I like to think we have free will. We can always course correct. I've shared this idea of revelation, meaning that's really important to me now, thinking that we are all in the process of revealing our inner divinity to ourselves and then to the world. I like this idea of revelation because it means it's always, always already there. So it's revealing itself through the circumstances we find ourselves in through our journey. And definitely we can assist that with that focus. But the idea of prophecy, if you recall from last time, is in my definition, not about saying that a certain thing is going to happen at a certain time in the future, but it's about going back to those three classifications of humanity I described. If you remember, we talked about the plank on head group. I say that affectionately. We've all been there. We talked about the certified life coach group. Again, affectionately, we've all been there. I still occupy that space a lot in my life. And then the I am space, which is where that revelation of divinity is truly flowering and truly blossoming in an exponential quickening. So, and that is home. That is who we really are. But when we talked about those three sort of large classes to distinguish this movement toward that ultimate revelation, the plank on head, again, was that really dense consciousness that has a lot of groupthink involved in it. The certified life coach is where we become more educated, more skillful with the use of our mind, but the egoic structures and identities and loves of our education and our scholarship and you know, still pursuing goals in the external world first, as opposed to the internal world first, that is that group. And it's much more helpful than the first group. There's more nuance and suppleness in terms of being able to receive a differing opinion or a differing idea. But we have to be more careful, I would argue, with how the ego likes to manifest it in that certified life coach, which is why I called it that. We like our certifications. We like our books and our philosophies and learning about boundaries and learning about all these things. It's an essential moment in time that we educate ourselves, that we start using the mind in a different way. Just don't stop there. That's the point. Don't get stuck there needlessly over too long a period of time, because we're meant to move into the I am, where we are just the revelation of what is moving through us and about us and into the unknown, making the unknown our home, our friend, our guide, our wingman, however you want to say that. And that is where we are really profoundly creating from the inside out, where order is restoring itself in our psyches and revealing itself in beautiful ways in our external world, in our resources, in our relationships, in our health. And that's where the juice is for me right now. And back to this idea of prophecy, I feel that those who have gone before us, C.G. Jung, Peter Kingsley, definitely two examples who are in the course of their work, past and present, speaking more from this third space of the I am. It's not that they don't dip back into the certified life coach category, because you sort of have to be in that space a bit to navigate the external world and, you know, get an article published or go to the bank or whatever. I mean, there's a certain amount of that required in a human experience, but they are more situated. Their center of gravity is far more rooted. I would add Neville Goddard. I love, love, love his work. He always brings me back home. Somehow I really, really resonate with his work. And he was definitely, I've talked about him in the past, by the way, if you want to go back, and I'm sure I'll do some more Neville in the future. Just love him. But anyway, he was definitely moving in the I am space. And that space when you look at the events that are unfolding in the collective, then the collective that we all share, I feel that those who are centered in the I am clearly see what's going on and can be somewhat quote unquote prophetic because they see events in a very different way than those of us who are still predominantly in the certified life coach and certainly those who are in the plank on head. And I hope these categories aren't too weird for people, but I just wanted to keep it kind of light and funny because, again, we are all murder and mayhem. I've said that before. We are all dysfunction. We are all gods and goddesses in process of revelation. So it's not that anybody is going to get out of not being in these loops of experience. The good news is, you know, I think the quote unquote ending, which, you know, at least for the earth experience is a very happy one. It's this joyful reunion. So having said all that, I just wanted to bring back this idea of prophecy belonging largely to those who are seeing current events and speaking on them and tracking psyche in that space. And I think their thoughts are more reliable. Now, having said that, Peter Kingsley is a self-identified trickster. He says that. And part of the prophet's role historically is to wake people up. So the books that Peter Kingsley has are very circular in fashion. They're really hard to summarize. They're really hard to put in any kind of logical order because it's getting at a different kind of wisdom and it kind of tips us on our heads and penetrates when we're least suspecting it. And there's a trickster nature to it. So I just wanted to remind us of those things. We went through the essay by Brian Brewer last time that summarized Peter Kingsley's reality. And I just want to touch on a few concepts from that work that carry forth into his book, Catafalque, which we will talk more about today. And again, I'm also relying on another scholar's summary of Catafalque because I appreciate that scholarly discipline that's able to articulate this really complex material. It's not complex to the soul, but it is complex to our conditioned way of human thinking. So that's kind of the weird paradox of this is it's sort of hard to articulate or to situate, but then it like totally makes sense to your soul. So that's just how I've experienced Jung my whole life, certainly how I'm experiencing Peter Kingsley. It's hard to articulate and it pushes back against our human and egoic assumptions about what life and reality are. Having said that, like the soul is like, give me more of that. I am so down with that. That is nourishing to me. Keep talking, keep feeling, keep leaning into that. So the ideas that I want to set forth in Peter Kingsley's work, just to bring us all to the same page again, he is going back in Western civilization historically to look at the roots of our spiritual traditions, since Western civilization often borrows from other traditions, be they Native American or Far Eastern, etc. So here we are with the Greek tradition, and we are talking about Parmenides and Empedocles somewhere around 500 BC to 494 BC, you know, so roughly in that area. And Peter Kingsley is talking about the rational, which we so privilege in our modern culture. The rational, he reveals, is truly and originally meant to serve oneness and wholeness. And only as philosophy evolved, quote unquote, in one sense, did it start dissecting everything. It started dissecting and not serving oneness, not serving the whole. And so Peter Kingsley, who again is a Cambridge scholar, he is a scholar's scholar. He is not easy to dismiss, but he's coming from this I am, I would argue, space now in his writings. And he's saying the rational originally served wholeness. That's really important concept. Okay. Another one he introduces in reality, to think something is to make it exist. To think something is to make it exist. Or another way of saying that is if you can conceive of something in your imagination, it already exists. It already exists. That is a powerful, life-changing statement right there, which is taking us from certified life coach to the I am space. The I am space navigates from the imaginal to the material. From the imaginal space to the material space, not the other way around. That is real power. And we have to go through that certified life coach space, I would argue, to become good and responsible people so as not to exploit that power for selfish reasons. You know, there's an order to this, even though it is not something that can be mapped, if you will. There is a fullness of arrival. Maybe that's a better way to say it. I really don't like the word order, but that's me. Anyway, to think something is to make it exist. Wow, there's a lot of responsibility and a lot of joy in that statement. Remember another concept of reality, love and strife are the forces of the universe that we can basically boil everything down to. Things are either coming together or things are coming apart. And we have the spell of Aphrodite, if you remember back to mystery school, is love. And so let me unpack that a bit. Love and strife, things coming together, things coming apart. Of course, we prefer the love, right? We prefer that. However, we get very clear and very focused when strife is happening, so we can't always say that that is not welcome. Sometimes it's what brings the clarity and the impetus for consciousness. So, but having said that, all the beautiful aspects of quote-unquote love or Aphrodite's spell, as Peter Kingsley says, is something to also keep in sharp focus, because it also is part of the illusion of being a human being, because you are actually divine. So don't get lost in the luxury and the love spell as well, because ultimate love, ultimate being is a very different definition of love. That's more in the oneness category, in the I am beingness category, a transcendent love. The love, quote unquote, that we experience on the earth plane, whether that's with a partner or work you enjoy or just beautiful moments of being in sync with your environment, we can love all that. But remember also that it's Aphrodite's spell. Peter Kingsley, through the Parmenides and Empedocles' work, reminds us that Persephone is the goddess to actually be having a relationship with, meaning the goddess of the underworld, our ability to die before we die. In other words, to let this ego self come into submission to the full self, with a capital S, to life itself. To die before we die actually helps us live, and we enjoy the forms of love, and we experience the slings and arrows of strife less personally and less radically than we did before. always returning to being and the I am state as we grow in consciousness. And we're always home. We're always okay. And that consciousness is really, really important to what's happening in the collective. It's helping the collective sort of move forward. And it's sort of in fits and starts. I would definitely say we're all feeling that right now. But we can really contribute to all the cacophony of things that is happening externally by doing this inner discipline. Another reality principle is the paradox that all is divine. And I think another way of saying that is to not judge, because realizing that we're all in the process of awakening, that even strife and difficulty is a way to reframe something and drop back into stillness and take us home, doesn't mean we have to love what's happening or that we're not going to use the imagination from the I am space to affect powerful change. We will do that. We will do that. Knowing that the I am resonance and frequency and consciousness of that still point is the most glorious thing we could ever do. Just being the divinity that we are. Nothing can eclipse that. But that's something that has to reveal itself through us experientially. That life coach category is definitely of the mind. The I am is of experience, raw out experience. You're out of the head. You are in the imagination, perhaps, which may be localized in our human, you know, pineal area, but you're not in the head space in terms of mental concepts. You are in experience. You are experiencing the divine awaken in you and affect your life in miraculous ways. Which brings us back to this idea of metis. And I've been saying metis with that pronunciation, which actually, if I were Greek, it's more like metis, something like that, metis. I'm going to take that liberty and keep saying metis because it makes me think of meta. And that's helpful to me, but know that I'm not Greek and I'm not trying to, you know, torture that pronunciation. It's likely said another way if you are of the Greek language. And I apologize. I'm sticking with metis for that reason because I'm thinking meta. But anyway, that powerful present moment access to your divinity. And not only to your divinity, but to all divinity that is in harmony and in the unknown working on your behalf. So you have access not only to the beautiful part of the facet of the divine that you represent, but you have incredible resources serving the oneness that you would not have access to from a mental space, from a logical or rational in the old sense of how it became morphed, meaning not serving oneness space. So metis is that idea of dying before we die because we're dropping into that stillness and allowing that to do its work on our egoic, role-centered, identity-centered part of us that wants to hold on to all of that for security or for, you know, importance, and or just letting that white light of divinity pierce through and affect things magically, miraculously. We have access to such tremendous problem-solving and creative matrix in that space. That's really exciting to be a part of. And you know when it's happening. You know when something is moving through you or arriving in your external world that is just out of the blue, seemingly. But you know it's linked to you somehow, and it's harmonious, and it's powerful, and it's serving all. You know, it may be serving you specifically, but not because it's taking away from anybody else. And few examples of problem solving, you know, from the external world first, are able to accomplish that. I would argue maybe none. You know, it's compromise is pretty much the best we can do when we're only focused on the external, and that only lasts for a while. People are never happy with compromise. I see that more and more all the time. Medicine is the way to fly. You know, that's the only way to fly. It's the only miraculous, truly intelligent choice. So it seems very logical to go for medicine in my estimation. So that sort of summarizes, again, there's so much to unpack with Peter Kingsley, but those are some of the highlights that we have focused on that I think are enormously helpful. Remember, he calls himself out as being a trickster. He says, I'm sure you'll accuse me of inflation, meaning, you know, like I'm on my own ego trip here, or archetypal, you know, dysfunctional trip here. You may think I'm crazy, all the rest of it. I know people looked at Jung that way too. And remember, we touched on the fact that Jung often spoke of speaking from personality number one or number two. And a real easy way to think of that is he was either in the certified life coach space, personality number one, or in the IM space, personality number two. And what made the difference for him was his encounter with the unconscious, which produced the Red Book. And that changed everything. That was an experiential encounter with the divine that then started living itself through the person of C.G. Jung. And that's powerful and miraculous. And when he was speaking from personality number two, he might, depending on the audience, dismiss something that was actually really important, or speak in a riddle, or speak very very plainly, but from this paradoxical space, which would sound crazy to people that are deeply rooted still in certified life coach or personality number one space. And again, we're all in all of these spaces. There's no judgment, but sometimes you pick your audience. If you are listening to this podcast, you're probably quite well versed in that middle space of wanting to use the mind more effectively. And you're probably leaning into the unknown space, the I am space. And, you know, it's a unique journey for each of us in those two spaces. But that's kind of the work of this podcast. And again, so thankful to have folks to share that with. Jung talked about one of the few people that he had the opportunity to speak freely from his personality number two is Henry Corbin. And the joy of being able to do that was exquisite for him, because there aren't a lot of people you can speak about these things with in that way that are also experiencing that come alive within them. And that is a precious, precious thing, because this journey of individuation, of revelation, however you would like to characterize it, is an alone one. It's not, well, at times it can be lonely, but that loneliness is also an identity that falls away, I would argue. And in fact, Henry Corbin, I think, has a book called Alone with the Alone. And that right there is a great indication that he's living this space, the I am space, alone with the alone. But it's not lonely at that time, at that moment, because you are dwelling with eternity. You are dwelling with love in its cosmic, universal beingness definition, not just Aphrodite's spell on the earth. So that sort of gets us back on to the same page here, and I'll just make a few comments again about C.G. Jung and prophecy. I think a large portion of the Jungian community doesn't like thinking of Jung as a prophet. They like Jung in that middle space of academia and scholarship. And there are many programs and learning centers and universities and graduate schools created around his work. All of that is good. But I think it's really important to say that Jung himself resisted that. That is just a fact that he did. And in fact, he would say to Henry Corbin, who was the soulmate of his in terms of being able to talk about personality, number two, he would famously say to Henry Corbin after one of their meetings in his booming voice, "Thank God I'm not a Jungian." That is a powerful statement. He didn't like this body of work that flourished from his encounter with the unconscious being pinned down. I myself have benefited so much from Jung's work, but we cannot pin it down. We cannot sort of write it in stone and not let it breathe. Its purpose, I would argue, is to come alive in you in its own individual way. And that's going to look different for every single person. And you have to go at this alone at some point and leave those guardrails behind. So the Jungian work, the Peter Kingsley work, are great markers along the way. I would certainly add Eckhart Tolle's work. Those are great signposts along the way. I think they're the real deal. But you ultimately, moving into the I am space, that's you and the divine. So Jung had this ultimate vision of, in terms of archetypes of the self, with a capital S, meaning that full-on oneness. But in terms of the masculine and the feminine, which I know, again, can be problematic in terms of, you know, limiting ourselves with those gendered identities. But for argument's sake, let's just return to the idea that we all have the yin and the yang within us, the active and the receptive. And Jung himself said often that the feminine was closer to the archetype of the self. And I would argue that's because of its state of receptivity and beingness, which you ultimately have to come to. We as ego-centered people still want to go out and conquer the world and go affect change. It's easy to slip into that illusion. And indeed, we need to do that for a while until we don't. And then you have to get comfortable with creating from the space of beingness, from the imaginal, from the archetypal imaginal space. And we'll talk more about that in the future. I want to do a podcast again on imagination soon. But Jung said that the feminine, or in its historical or Gnostic sense, Sophia, the Sophianic principle, was the closest to the self. In the dream life, sometimes the divine child will appear when one is approaching the self with a capital S, but the anima, the Sophia principle, is very, very close, very near the divine self. And that's not to say that the masculine, the conscious masculine, isn't exquisite in its own right. It's just a matter of moving, I would argue, from active principle to beingness. And so, again, we're all calling on all of these aspects of ourselves. It's wonderful to have a healthy masculine that can use the active principle in the external world. It's wonderful to have the conscious masculine serving the conscious feminine and creating a protective space for her, not because she ultimately needs protected, but it's like the bullshit screen, you know, like saying, you know, enough, this needs to stay out here so that the Sophianic, the beingness of the feminine can move into the space of the self. That's a beautiful coalescence of the miraculous. And I would argue that the masculine, the conscious masculine, sort of holds his sword in the mental space so that that can happen. You know, it says, I am not allowing doubt anymore. I know who I am, and I'm holding my sword in an active space in the psyche or the external world to allow this to come to fruition. So again, it's all working beautifully together, and it's working in ways that you can't even articulate. But I wanted to put a pin in that Henry Corbin and C.G. Jung did speak about Sophia, which is the Gnostic idea of the goddess or the feminine face of God. We could do a whole series on that, and maybe I need to learn more about that as well. But I wanted to at least touch on that idea of the divine feminine, which echoes back to Parmenides, because in his revelatory poem, he was meeting a goddess in the underworld, arguably Persephone, in terms of a mythic figure or an archetypal figure. So here is this idea of the conscious masculine and the conscious feminine, you know, really in the divine marriage of the self. So having shared all of that, I am going to use the review of Catafalque, Peter Kingsley's Catafalque, by M. Laura Gemelli Marciano. I so appreciate this scholar's work at summarizing Catafalque, because again, Peter Kingsley, from his I Am space, speaks in a very circular fashion, and it's tricky. I want to define Catafalque for those of you who are unfamiliar with that term. I had to look it up. And it is the structure upon which a casket sits when someone is lying in state. So, for example, Abraham Lincoln's catafalque has been used several times over when presidents post-Lincoln have passed and they lie in state at the Capitol. The casket sits upon the catafalque. So here's Peter Kingsley's trickster, shocking, provocative nature coming at us in the very title, just like reality. Whose reality? The reality. So these are very provocative titles. And catafalque, my God, like it's suggesting, are we preparing indeed for the end of humanity? What does that mean? Does that mean, and I think it's fair to say that Peter Kingsley is talking about all the strife and the outliers that are suddenly apparent in the culture. What's happening? Are we moving from things coming together to things moving apart? The love strife continuum. Are we moving into a space where things are coming apart again? That is a powerful, and I'm just going to leave it as a rhetorical question right now. I'm not going to say we all have to live that answer for ourselves, but we can also be part of living an answer that we wish to live. So the way that these forces are moving through the culture and moving through us as we wake up to the divine within us, I think we have a say in how tumultuous we want that to be. And we always can return to Metis. We can always return to that which is home, which is always going to supply all of our needs, which is love itself, not in the Aphroditic sense, but love in the large oneness sense. It is security, it is joy, it is peace. That is with every single one of us at any moment. It is the present moment. But Peter Kingsley is really skillful in pointing out that, quote unquote, the present moment can also really get, this is my word, memed, you know, put around on Facebook or Instagram. Oh, I'm just in the present moment. And it's cheapened. That's a very different thing than being in the white hot space of it and listening and allowing it to fill you up. So, you know, Peter Kingsley points to the fact that an experiential space of metis is very different than, oh yeah, let's be in the present moment and go get ice cream. You know, okay, but more is required. And we're capable of that. And it matters, I would argue, Peter Kingsley is saying, that we embrace that work. Jung, at the end of his life, had some very disturbing, quote-unquote, prophetic dreams that his family and his closest associates didn't even want to talk about. And he talked about seeing the end of the world and seeing sort of a scorched space. Peter Kingsley talks about those things in Catafalque. And I just think it's important to hold several paradoxical ideas together, that perhaps we are heading into a cycle where there is going to be more strife, more things coming apart. That may be the case. Awakening is also happening, and indeed, strife is a huge catalyst for awakening. When we're sort of lulled by Aphrodite's spell, we're less inclined to wake up. We use the archetypal imagination to center and to create what we want to create, having the external reflect the beauty and the mandala creation of the psyche. In other words, the psyche might be in all sorts of fractured spaces within us as we're moving through individuation. But Jung often returned to mandalas and created them and drew them and colored them. And they were symbolic of what was happening in his own psyche, where there was this beautiful order creating itself that was reflected in his work, and such a gift to so many of us who resonate with his work and from that perspective. So these paradoxical ideas that strife, maybe we're heading into a cycle of strife, maybe, I'll just say it, Peter Kingsley offers that Western humanity, Western civilization has already fallen, and that the external just hasn't caught up with it yet. I don't know how to answer that in terms of, is this his trickster calling us to action in terms of our inner walk? Is this something to, I don't know. I don't have the answers. I'm just stating what's there in that work, Catafalque. And he does say it has already fallen. That is his prophetic understanding. But again, I don't hold to, and nor does Peter Kingsley, I would argue, if I'm understanding him correctly, when we're moving into the I am space, we are creating the world in which we are inhabiting with every breath. And so how I'm processing sort of this harbinger of doom, if you wanted to look at it from the ego's perspective of strife and the end of Western civilization, I'm choosing to look at that as it is essential to occupy the space of metis and to allow the divine to be born and to do the mental discipline. And this is what I have to offer. And this is what will allow whatever is happening in the greater scheme for me to be a part of something in which I am safe and secure and blessed and loved and contributing. So we're all going to have to wrangle with these ideas ourselves and come to our own truths about them. That's something I really seek to do in the podcast, is to allow you to have your own journey with any of the material I present. So I'm just trying to present the material and bring it up for conversation and your own contemplation. But these are difficult truths of prophecy, if you will, that Peter Kingsley and Jung have talked about. And it just needs to be said. And then what we do with that is part of our awakening consciousness. So having said that, I want to dive into this Marciano summary of, it's actually entitled Revisiting Jung and Corbin. You know, Corbin being the person he could speak about personality number two with, a review of Peter Kingsley's Catafalque. I'm not going to read the whole article because it's quite lengthy, but I want to hit several highlights. And hopefully the highlights I have chosen will inspire you to read Catafalque for yourself, if that is appropriate. And they will also echo all that I've been talking about thus far in part one and part two, to sort of bring it home, at least for now, because these are ideas we will return to again and again, both in the podcast and in our own lives. So with that, this article begins with a quote that is actually C.G. Jung, and this was from his Emma Jung and Tony Wolfe collection of remembrances. I believe these were maybe letters. I'm not familiar with this particular work, but this is Jung speaking, and this is how Marciano begins the article. It is the truth, a force of nature that expresses itself through me. I am only a channel. I can imagine myself in many instances where I would become sinister to you. For instance, if life had led you to take up an artificial attitude, then you wouldn't be able to stand me because I am a natural being. By my very presence, I crystallize. I am a ferment. The unconscious of people who live in an artificial manner senses me as a danger. Everything about me irritates them. My way of speaking, my way of laughing. They sense nature. Okay. That is a powerful, powerful quote. And what I would argue is that Jung speaking from personality too is going to drive folks in plank on head, stark raving mad. And remember, everybody, including us, who has been in that space before, have moved beyond it in terms of consciousness. But it's an irritant when a fuller consciousness is speaking. And basically, he's likening that sensibility about him that he's living as nature, and it is natural. It is our natural home. And we are not to remain in that limited space, but those who are really asleep, who are densely in that consciousness state while they are there, will react to that. So I'm jumping in now with Marciano's words after that quote. These few words spoken by Jung during an interview in 1941 encapsulate the essence of Catafalque. The voice of nature speaks through the book, telling of the forgotten past and of what lies below the surface of our conscious world. This voice is very disturbing because both individually and collectively, we have lost any contact with nature, with the past, with ourselves. We live an artificial life dominated by technology, a seemingly helpful tool that unfortunately has a very dark side and is gradually transforming even our humanity into the most efficient machines of destruction. Jung warned throughout his life against the life-destroying lopsidedness of rationality, science, and technology. He emphasized instead the need for Westerners to make the journey back into the depth of themselves, to listen to the voices of the past and know what we are from the beginning before we can move into the future. This emphasis, as well as those warnings, mean that his was, and in spite of the artificial institutionalization of his work, still is, a voice crying in the wilderness. Kingsley allows that voice to resonate again, while being only too aware that in doing so, he will evoke endless misunderstandings and irritations. Okay, that's a powerful way to start this summary of Catafalque. They're both saying, you're going to think I'm crazy. You're going to call me inflated. It gives credence to the fact that they know that's how they will be perceived. Continuing on, at crucial points throughout Catafalque, Kingsley offers autobiographical details aimed at situating his work inside the context of a wider tradition of mystics, a tradition that includes Carl Jung and Henry Corbin, medieval alchemists, ancient Gnostics, and Hermetic teachers, but reaches back ultimately to the early Greek philosopher mystics, Parmenides and Empedocles. He vividly describes his encounters with Jung and Corbin, encounters in quotation marks, because I don't believe they actually ever met, but also his meetings with those Native American medicine men and women who helped him to understand what his task was, quote, to shock people into an awareness that all life comes from and returns to the sacred. Moving on in the article, after calling out that people will say he's inflated or, you know, on an ego trip, he warns that a potentially much more dangerous inflation is the one produced by our collective identification with an archetype which no one is ever conscious of, the archetype of the Anthropos, manifesting itself as the perfectly reasonable and ordinary and seemingly humble human being with all the usual delusions of individualism and illusions of reality. That is a tremendous statement. Let's just unpack that a bit. Basically, he's calling out that middle group that I lovingly refer to as certified life coach. He's like, that's one of the biggest illusions right there, is that we're these thoughtful, capable, scholarly, rational people, you know, humble even. You are a God awakening to itself. Anything less than that is going to hit a brick wall. That's my way of saying that. Let's continue. The truth is that Kingsley's own personal biography, just like the lives of Jung and Corbin and all other sages who have created and kept alive our Western culture, is not significant in itself because all of them are nothing but manifestations of the same impersonal energy that strives to reach consciousness through the lives and work of individual human beings. That sentence right there is pointing back to the oneness, to the self with a capital S, of which we are all a beautiful facet of. Jung understood this perfectly, so does Kingsley, and if we are tempted to dismiss what they say about the matter as some clever rhetorical or literary device, this means we are choosing to ignore what true wisdom was at the beginning of our Western culture and still is in those cultures which have not yet lost the link with their past or the awareness of their culture's purpose. Again, that purpose being to return to the sacred, to allow the sacred to experientially awaken in you, in the I am space. Continuing on further into the article, now, though times have changed, alongside the publication of Jung's previously secret and private Red Book, again, the Red Book being his recordings of his encounter with the unconscious, his own psychology has become more institutionalized than ever, while the overvaluation of rationalism at the expense of everything else has turned into an immensely destructive collective neurosis. So a salutary shock is needed, a shock that will allow us to free ourselves of old prejudices, rigid thinking patterns, and rediscover the real meaning as well as the source of science and knowledge. The problem is that research on Jung is so hopelessly weighed down by the need either to defend or attack him as a person, both parties being equally influenced by the same tired assumptions about the appropriate labels to use for classifying his experience and his ideas, that people have lost any real sense for what mattered most to Jung himself, which is the impersonal energy that lies behind every personal story. We're returning to that phrase over and over again in this article and in Catafalque. It is impersonal. I would argue that doesn't mean it isn't love in the cosmic sense, in the cosmic definition of beingness, that kind of love, that kind of oneness. But it is impersonal, and that's what Peter Kingsley was pointing to when he audaciously named his other book Reality. There is a reality. There is an impersonal, meaning it's not manifesting as Lori Green or John Smith or whatever. Ultimately, it's moving through those manifestations of people, but it's all part of the divine. So Lori Green is just a particular flavor of circumstances and maybe interests and talents that it's flowering through, but I'm not the end of the story. I am the divine, that facet awakening to myself, just like everybody else. So that's the impersonal reality behind all of the personal things we think matters so very, very much. Moving more deeply into the article, because the book is a great symbol in the Jungian sense, the author of the article was talking about reading Catafalque as kind of a trip, you know, my words. It's circumambulations. It's very tricky to read, and it sort of moves in and out upon itself. Again, as we know, to allow the trickster to penetrate the wisdom and move around the logical, rational intellect that wants to keep things orderly. And so therefore, the author of the article is calling the book itself a symbol in the Jungian sense, meaning a symbol can be an image or a sound or a taste or an experience that is representing something psychically much larger. And that is how we communicate most effectively in the archetypal imagination, is with symbols, as opposed to a bunch of words. So symbols convey to the unconscious what we're wishing to say and experience and create. As Jung used to say, to try and understand a symbol is the devil's way of killing it. And while Catafalque can help each of us enormously in understanding the darkness and depths of our own self, we would be wise to let the depths and darkness of the book remain a mystery. We have to constantly return to and honor the mystery and lean into it and trust it while not trying to pin it down. It cannot be pinned down. Quote, already in the first section of the book, Kingsley not only demonstrates the haunting parallelism between Plato's self-conscious murder of Parmenides and the gut-wrenching question with which the spirit of the depths confronts Carl Jung at the start of his Red Book, quote, have you counted the murderers among the scholars? So in other words, what the author is saying here is when we try to pin down people's experience, and when they've sought to articulate that in some way, we cease to allow that to be an image that can live in us. You know, you can't sort of rationalize it in the warped sense to death, because its very existence is that it's alive and moving and doing alchemical work on the soul and psychic level. He also demonstrates in the finest detail how exactly the same distortions that we already find in Plato's or Aristotle's ways of presenting pre-Socratic texts have been taking place all over again in the translations and publications of Jung's work during the last 50 years. In spite of all the warnings and clear guidelines, Jung is being murdered by his interpreters and followers in just the same way that Parmenides or Empedocles were murdered more than 2,000 years ago. Again, meaning their message and their words. Unlike Plato, Aristotle, later philosophers and religious scholars who valued light, daytime, ascent, the activity of thinking and reasoning, clarity of intellect and theory, what this lineage values most highly is darkness, night, descent into the underworld, deliberate ambiguity, stillness, and that mysterious essence of human experience, which we carry with us wherever we go, and that Jung referred to very simply as the dark substance. So this vision of the divine is not just the love and light version, which often occupies certified life coach mindset. This experience of the divine is all of it, the love and the strife, knowing that we don't identify with any of that darkness or light, but we are the beings giving birth to the God who is witnessing all of that, and it's just fine. It is just still. It is all powerful and all knowing, watching the dance. But Jung and Peter Kingsley's version of events, their perspective is that the darkness, the underworld, are included. And so much of contemporary religion is focused on the love and light. And in fact, I gag every time I hear that. Love and light, love and light. I mean, yeah, I want love and light experiences in my life. They are precious. But in my experience, to discard the other is to have to meet it coming at you in a really formidable way. We must acknowledge and allow space for the darkness as well, knowing that we are actually the witness, the being, the I am, that is watching the theater of all of it, watching the cosmic play. And moving back into the article, in regard to religion, quote unquote, Jung often emphasized that to him, that word had exactly the same meaning as the Latin religio, meaning careful attention, free from any belief or opinion, to every form in which the numinous manifests itself inside the human psyche. So there should be nothing scandalous about the fact that he saw his psychology as the fulfillment or realization of the old religion in a modern form. So he's using religion in a very vast sense, just like when he broke from Freud, largely over Freud's definition of libido being tied to the sex drives. Jung said, no, libido is life force, you know, this enormous concept of life force. Back to the article. So whenever Jung insisted that he was only interested in knowledge, not beliefs, he wasn't speaking as a scientist. He was speaking as a Gnostic. Nothing with him, as Kingsley shows, is what it seems to be on the surface. This is why exactly the same has happened with Jung's frequent use of the term empirical as a way of summarizing, justifying, defining his own work. It all sounds scientific and respectable enough considering the normal modern implications of the word. But the reality is that Jung himself, in line with ancient healing traditions, took the word in its strict etymological sense. An empiricist is someone who relies on direct seeing and inner experience while rejecting all dogmatic theory. So in other words, he's in the I am experiential space. And it's no coincidence at all that, as Kingsley reminds us, the prototypical empiricists were nothing like our modern rational scientists. They were the alchemists and magical healers, just like Empedocles, whose overriding concern was with the urgency of direct perception and experience, and exactly like Jung, in their total commitment to practical understanding and healing, didn't have a moment to waste on philosophical speculations or empty theories. Once again, it should be apparent that Jung has to be read on many levels. In the same way as when deciphering a palimpsest, where the most important text is not the one written on the surface, but what lies hidden underneath, he is not only allowing, but just as the same as Empedocles and Parmenides, positively inviting us to misinterpret what he says by leaving us free to trap ourselves in our expectations and superficial understandings. So again, we are deep in paradox. We are deep in having to use the material to travel alone into the unknown and let it do its experiential work. I would argue that Peter Kingsley and Jung are showing us the ways that they allowed this to penetrate them by way of example, but they're not saying you have to do this as I did it, because you can't. I mean, you have to find your own way, but there may be similarities. There may be guidance here, but ultimately we have to surrender to that experiential awakening of the divine within us. Moving back to the article, Jung had already hinted at the seriousness of the situation when, towards the end of his life, he insisted that fluency in reading ancient Greek and Latin was essential for a thorough understanding of the history of Western culture, or for any genuine understanding of psychology. His hinting also goes back to many years earlier, to the time when he described his teacher's home in the Red Book, and very carefully using ancient Greek script to spell out the name, noted that one of Philemon's most prized possession was the book Hermes Trismegistus. And as Kingsley documents with astonishing attention to detail, in appealing to these ancient hermetic books, Jung was not referring to the kind of generalities and grand philosophical theories that he so openly despised. He was referring above all to the uniquely vivid accounts in the Greek hermetic texts of the various psychological stages in the initiation process, the initial fear of going crazy, the student's utter terror in confronting the reality of the teacher, the despair and confusion that this fear and terror give rise to, the bewilderment in face of a teaching that can't be taught, and ultimately the bliss of becoming one with the whole of creation and with the life force behind all existence. I mean, you can't say it much better than that. These stages of the I am state look and feel like this. And it's so helpful to have recordings and texts of people who have traveled that path, knowing that we ultimately travel it alone in our own unique ways, but that these stages are ones that we will likely encounter, and to keep going, that's not the end of the story. The livingness that Jung referred to as synchronicity is part of this. So incorporating this, the aliveness, the synchronicity, the numinosity of this experiential lived experience. Okay, so the end of this article now brings things back full circle to Henry Corbin, a nod to that. And I'm just going to read again the ending of this article. In the fourth and final section of Catafalque, Kingsley enters into the deepest meaning of Corbin's teaching, adding many new details that were directly conveyed to him over the years by Corbin's wife, Stella. and discusses the mysterious connections between him and Jung. These connections are often disregarded by Corbin scholars, who love to place a particular emphasis on the philosophical side of his work, while Jung scholars have had their own reasons for keeping Corbin, as well as his philosophizing at a distance. But Kingsley at last goes beyond the outer differences, pointing to the real essence of their esoteric intimacy. This intimacy is not the same as merging with one another, but is a communion between two individuated people, two I am people, alone to the alone, each of them having their own particular relationship to their inner self and their specific task. Corbin's last talk with Jung in September 1955, as described by him so remarkably in some unpublished notes and documented by Kingsley, shows all the features of what among Sufis is known as sobet, the mystical conversation between companions who speak from the heart in the spontaneous experience of total freedom and joy. This is not to say that Corbin doesn't also recognize the natural differences between him and Jung, as is inevitable among individuated people who are ultimately alone with their own higher self in that same fundamental relationship of the alone to the alone. As Kingsley appropriately notes, any parting of the ways between them was not a parting in any conventional sense, but the parting of two knights at a crossroads who both have to follow their own paths in their shared search for the Grail. And Corbin is pointing to the same solitude when he presents Jung's Answer to Job, one of Jung's last books, as the work of this man alone, whose only strength lies in his soul, while also inviting all those who are alone to meditate on Jung's book and listen to its inner message, quote, if they truly are alone, meaning if you are in this I am process. He immediately adds that any authentic sense of togetherness is always born out of this solitude and in it. For Corbin, this often unbearable aloneness that he recognized in Jung was the clearest of pointers to the role played by prophets and by prophetic tradition in reflecting into existence the absolute aloneness of God. And Corbin hinted repeatedly at the prophetic character of Jung as well as Jung's work, both in his famous review of Answer to Job and also elsewhere, which explains why the realities of prophecy were such a major theme in the discussions between the two men. But for him, the single most important link with prophecy in the whole of Jung's work was the central role given to true imagination, imaginatio vera, as the power responsible for creating inner and outer reality. Not only did both Jung and Corbin consider this a natural manifestation of the numinous, something totally real and completely different from our usual self-indulgent fantasy, for Corbin, just as for Jung, this faculty of true imagination belongs above all to prophets. The article goes on to say that at Jung's funeral, very few people were able to sum up everything about him, but the pastor did say and acknowledge Jung as a prophet, and then said, a prophet who has stemmed the flood of rationalism and given man the courage to have a soul again. So, concluding the article here, these last few lines are really important. In fact, this is the same prophetic spirit that blows everywhere in his work, just under the surface of the scientific language, not just Jung's newly published Red Book, but also the tone and content of Ion or Answer to Job, the repeated and passionate warnings not to overvalue reason or science at the expense of the unconscious, because otherwise we will end up substituting ourselves for God. are only the most evident signs of his prophetic task, and judging from the way that events are unfolding now around the globe, with the growth of a hyper-rational society, which, in spite of our feeble talk about progress, is drawing us back unconsciously and collectively into a primitive state, we can now see how true Jung's prophecies were. Kingsley devotes the final pages of Catafalque to the last visions of Jung, as well as his own dreams and visions, tracing out the desolate outlines of the ending of our culture. This is something to be taken very seriously because, as Jung said, while still a relatively young man in his 40s, quote, when the rational way proves to be a cul-de-sac, as it always does after a time, the solution comes from the side it was least expected, which is the side of the prophets. And rather than continue to torture those prophets by distorting or silencing their voices, we would be far better to join the author of Catafalque in his lament for the dead, while giving all those who from the beginning have seeded and nurtured our culture the respect and peace they deserve. And in my own words, just echoing, we are sacred and we must live in the sacred manner and return to the sacred. That is not the religious in the small sense, but the sacred, the religious in the large, experiential, revelatory God, goddess sense. So, without even intending to, I've certainly set up another podcast to talk about imagination. I don't know when that's going to come, but it will come soon because I'm just sitting with all this material right now and I'm definitely working very lovingly and intentionally with archetypal imagination in my own life right now. So, I hope this entire discussion, parts one and two, has been helpful, has encouraged you to seek out your own paths through the material and through, most importantly, your own experience as you live this and allow this revelation of who you are to completely embrace and empower and delight you. And with great thanks to all of these writers I am sharing with you, I mean, they've been of invaluable help to me, but we experience this part of ourselves no matter what, because it's who we really are. And so, to the extent this is helpful, I'm delighted and in kinship with you. And we will check in again soon. Wishing you a happy August. Wishing you a beautiful first harvests cycle. And until next time, take good care. Ooh. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.